Track 8.
I found my medical kit had been broken open and scattered during the previous day's looting, but I retrieved sufficient material to clean and dress Sherry's mutilated fingers. 3 of the nails had been torn out. I feared that the roots had been destroyed and that they'd never grow again. But when Sherry expressed the same fears, I denied them stoutly. Once her injuries were taken care of, I made her swallow a couple of codeine for the pain and made a bed for her in the darkness of the back of the cave. Rest, I told her, kneeling to kiss her tenderly. Try and sleep. I'll fetch you when we're ready to leave. Chubby was already busy with the necessary tasks. He had checked the whaleboat, and apart from a few shrapnel holes, found it in good condition. We filled the holes with Prattley's putty from the tool chest and left her on the beach. The hole in which the chest had been buried served as a communal grave for the dead men and the woman lying about it. We laid them in it like sardines, and covered them with a soft sand. We exhumed the golden head from its own grave, with its glittering eyes still in the broad forehead, and staggering under its weight, we carried it down to the whaleboat and padded it with the polythene cushions in the bottom of the boat. The plastic packets of sapphires and emeralds I pitched into my haversack and laid it beside the head. Then we returned to the caves and salvaged all the undamaged stores and equipment, the jerry cans of water and petrol, the scuba bottles and the compressor. It was late afternoon before we'd packed it all into the whaleboat, and I was tired. I laid the FN rifle on top of the load and stood back. "Okay, Chubby," I asked as I lit our cheroots and we took our first break. "I reckon we can take off now." Chubby drew on the cheroot and blew a long flag of blue smoke before he spat on the sand. "I just want to go up and fetch Angelo," he muttered. And when I stared at him, he went on, "I'm not going to leave the kid up there. It's too lonely here. He'll want to be with his own people in a Christian grave." So, while I went back to the caves to fetch Sherry, Chubby selected a bolt of canvas and went off into the gathering darkness. I woke Sherry and made sure she was warmly dressed in one of my jerseys, and then I gave her 2 more codeine and took her down towards the beach. It was dark now, and I held the flashlight in one hand and helped Sherry with the other. We reached the beach, and I paused uncertainly. There was something wrong, I knew, and I played the torch over the loaded vessel. And then I realized what it was, and I felt a sick little jolt in my belly. The FN rifle was no longer where I'd left it in the whaleboat. "Sherry," I whispered urgently, "get down and stay there till I tell you." She sank swiftly to the sand beside the beached hull, and I looked around frantically for a weapon. I thought of the spear gun, but it was under the jerry cans. My bait knife was still pegged into a palm tree in the grove. I'd forgotten about it until this moment. A spanner from the toolbox, perhaps, but the thought was as far as I got. "All right, Harry. I've got the gun." The deep, throaty voice spoke out of the darkness close behind me. "Don't turn around or do anything stupid." He must have been lying up in the grove after he'd taken the rifle, and now he'd come up silently behind me. I froze. "Without turning round, just toss that flashlight back towards me." I did as he ordered, and I heard the sand crunch under his feet as he stooped to pick it up. "All right. Now turn round, slowly." As I turned, he shone the powerful beam into my eyes, dazzling me. However, I could still vaguely make out the big, hulking shape of the man beyond the beam. "Have a good swim, Suleiman?" I asked. I could see that he wore only a pair of short white underpants, and his enormous belly and thick, shapeless legs gleamed wetly in the reflected torchlight. "I am beginning to develop an allergy to your jokes, Harry." He spoke again in that deep, beautifully modulated voice, and I remembered too late how a grossly overweight man becomes light and strong in the supporting salt water of the sea. However, Even with the turd of the tide to help him, Suleymandada had performed a formidable feat in surviving the explosion and swimming back through almost 2 miles of choppy water. I doubted any of his men had done as well. "I think it should be in the belly first," he spoke again, and I saw that he held the stock of the rifle across his left elbow. With the same hand he aimed the torch beam into my face. "They tell me that is the most painful place to get it." We were silent for a moment, and then Suleymandada, breathing with his deep asthmatic wheeze, and I trying desperately to think of some way in which to distract him long enough to give me a chance to grab the barrel of the FN. "I don't suppose you'd like to go down on your knees and plead with me?" he asked. "Go screw yourself, Suleiman," I answered. No, I didn't really think you would. A pity. I would have enjoyed that. But what about the girl, Harry? Surely it would be worth a little of your pride." We both heard Chubby. He had known there was no way he could cross the open beach undetected, even in the dark. He had tried to rush Suleymandada, but I'm sure he knew that he wouldn't make it. What he was really doing was giving me the distraction I so desperately needed. He came fast out of the darkness, running in silently with only the squeak of the treacherous sand beneath his feet to betray him. Even when Suleymandada turned the rifle onto him, he didn't falter in his charge. There was the crack of the shot and the long lightning flash of the muzzle blast. But even before that, I was halfway across the distance that separated me from the huge black man. From the corner of my eye, I saw Chubby fall, and then Suleymandada began to swing the rifle back towards me. I brushed past the rifle of the FN and crashed shoulder first into his chest. It should have staved his ribs in like the victim of a car smash. Instead, I found the power of my rush absorbed in the thick padding of the dark flesh. It was like running into a feather mattress. And although he reeled back a few paces and lost the rifle, Suleymandada remained upright on those two thick tree trunks of his legs, and before I could recover my own balance, I was enfolded in a vast bear hug. He picked me up off my feet and pulled me to his mountainous soft chest, trapping both my arms and lifting me so that I couldn't brace my legs to resist his weight and strength. I experienced a chill of disbelief when I felt the strength of the man. Not a hard, brutal strength, but something so massive and weighty that there seemed no end to it, almost like the irresistible push and surge of the sea. I tried with my elbows and knees, kicking and striking to break his hold, but the blows found nothing solid and made no impression upon the man. Instead, the enfolding grip of his arms began to tighten with the slow, pulsing power of a giant python. I realized instantly that he was quite capable of literally crushing me to death, and I experienced a sense of panic. I twisted and struggled frantically and unavailingly in his arms. But as he brought more of his immense power to bear upon me, so his breathing wheezed more harshly, and he leaned forward, hunching his great shoulders over me and forcing me back into an arc that soon must snap my spine. I bent back my head, reached up with an open mouth, and I locked my teeth into the broad, flattened nose. I bit in hard, with all my desperation, and quite clearly I felt my teeth slice through the flesh and gristle of his nose, and instantly my mouth was filled with the warm, salty, metallic flood of his blood. Like a dog at a bull baiting, I worried and tugged at his nose. The man bellowed a roar of agony and anger, and he released his crushing grip from around my body to try and tear my teeth from his face. The instant my arms were free, I twisted convulsively and got a purchase with both feet in the firm, wet sand, so I could put my hip into him for the throw. He was so busy attempting to dislodge the grip of my teeth from his nose that he could not resist the throw, and as he went over backwards, my teeth tore loose, cutting away a lump of his living flesh. I spat out the horrid mouthful, but the warm blood streamed down my chin, and I resisted the temptation to pause and wipe it clean. Suleymandada was down on his back, stranded like some massive, crippled black frog. But he wouldn't remain helpless much longer. I had to take him out cleanly now, and there was only one place where he might be vulnerable. I jumped up high over him and came down to knee drop into his throat, to drive my one knee with the full weight and momentum of my body into his larynx and crush it. He was swift as a cobra, throwing up both arms to shield his throat and to catch me as I descended onto him. Once again I was enmeshed by those thick black arms, and we rolled down the beach, locked chest to chest, into the warm shallow water of the lagoon. In a direct contrast of weight for weight like this, I was outmatched, and he came up over me with blood streaming from his injured nose, still bellowing with anger, and he pinned me into the shallows, forcing my head below the surface, and bearing down on my chest and lungs with all his vast weight. I began to drown. My lungs caught fire, and the need to breathe laced my vision with sparks and whirls of fire. I could feel the strength going out of me, and my consciousness receding into blackness. The shot, when it sounded, was muted and dull. I didn't recognize it for what it was, until I felt Suleiman Dada jerk and stiffen, felt the strength go out of him, and his weight slip and fall from me. I sat up, coughing and gasping for air, with water cascading from my hair and streaming into my eyes. In the light of the fallen torch, I saw Sherry North kneeling on the sand at the edge of the water. She had the rifle still clutched in her bandaged hand, and her face was pale and frightened. Beside me, Suleiman Dada floated face down in the shallow water, his half-naked body glistening blackly like a stranded porpoise. I stood up slowly, water pouring from my clothing, and she stared at me, horrified with what she'd done. "Oh, God," she whispered. "I've killed him. Oh, God." "Baby," I gasped, "that was the best day's work you've ever done." And I staggered past her to where Chubby lay. He was trying to sit up, struggling feebly. "Take it easy, Chubby," I snapped at him and picked up the torch. There was fresh blood on his shirt, and I unbuttoned it and pulled it around the broad brown chest. It was low and left, but it was a lung hit. I saw the bubbles frothing from the dark hole at each breath. I've seen enough gunshot wounds to be something of an authority, and I knew that this was a bad one. He watched my face. "How does it look?" he grunted. "It's not sore." "Lovely," I answered grimly. "Every time you drink a beer, it'll run out of the hole." He grinned crookedly, and I helped him to sit up. The exit hole was clean and neat. The FN had been loaded with solid ammunition, and it was only slightly larger than the entry hole. The bullet had not mushroomed against bone. I found a pair of field dressings in the medical chest and bound up the wounds before I helped him into the boat. Sherry had prepared one of the mattresses, and we covered him with blankets. "Don't forget Angelo," he whispered. I found the long, heartbreaking canvas bundle where Chubby had dropped it, and I carried Angelo down and laid him in the bows. I shoved the whaleboat out until I was waist-deep, and then I scrambled over the side and started the engines. My one concern now was to get proper medical attention for Chubby, but it was a long, cold run down the islands to St. Mary's. Sherry sat beside Chubby on the floorboards, doing what little she could for his comfort, while I stood in the stern between the motors and negotiated the deep water channel, before turning southwards under a sky full of cold white stars, bearing my cargo of wounded, dying, and dead. We'd been going for almost 5 hours when Sherry stood up from beside the blanketed form in the bottom of the boat and made her way back to me. "Chubby wants to talk to you," she said quietly. And then, impulsively, she leaned forward and touched my cheek with the cold fingers of her uninjured hand. "I think he's going, Harry," and I heard the desolation in her voice. I passed the con to her. "You see those two bright stars?" And I showed her the pointers of the Southern Cross. "Steer straight for them," and I went forward to where Chubby lay. For a while he didn't seem to know me, and I knelt beside him and listened to the soft, liquid sound of his breathing. And then at last he became aware. I saw the starlight catch his eyes, and he looked up at me. And I leaned closer so that our faces were only inches apart. "We took some good fish together, Harry," he whispered. "Oh, we're going to take a lot more," I answered. With what we've got aboard now, we'll be able to buy a really good boat. You and I will be going for billfish again next season, that's for sure." And then we were silent for a long time, until at last I felt his hand grope for mine, and I took it and held it hard. I could feel the calluses and ancient line burns from handling heavy fish. "Harry." His voice was so faint I could just hear it over the sound of the motors when I laid my ear to his lips. "Harry, I'm going to tell you something I never told you before. I love you, man," he whispered. "I love you better than my own brother." "And I love you too, Chubby," I said. And for a little longer his grip was strong again, and then it relaxed. I sat on beside him while slowly that big horny paw turned cold in my hands, and dawn began to pale the sky above the dark and brooding sea. During the next 3 weeks, Sherry and I seldom left the sanctuary of Turtle Bay. We went together to stand awkwardly in the graveyard while they buried our friends, and once I drove alone to the fort and spent 2 hours with President Godfrey Biddle and Inspector Wally Andrews. But the rest of that time we were alone while the wounds healed. Our bodies healed more quickly than did our minds. One morning as I dressed Sherry's hand, I noticed the pearly white seeds in the healing flesh of her fingertips, and realized that they were the nail roots regoing. She would have fingernails once more to grace those long, narrow hands. I was thankful for that. They weren't happy days. The memories were too fresh, and the days were dark with mourning for Chubby and Angelo, and both of us knew that the crisis of our relationship was at hand. I guessed what agonies of decision she must be facing, and I forgave her the quick flares of temper, the long, sullen silences, and her sudden disappearances from the shack when, for hours at a time, she walked the long, deserted beaches, or made a remote and lonely figure sitting out on the headland of the bay. At last I knew that she was strong enough to face what lay ahead for both of us. One evening I raised the subject of the treasure, for the first time since our return to St. Mary's. It was now buried beneath the raised foundations of the shack. Sherry listened quietly as we sat together upon the veranda, drinking whiskey, and listening to the sound of the night surf on the beach. "I want you to go ahead to make the arrangements for the arrival of the coffin. Hire a car in Zurich and drive down to Basel. I've arranged a room for you at the Red Ox Hotel there. I picked that hotel because they have an underground parking garage, and I know the head porter there. His name is Max. I explained my plans to her. He'll arrange a hearse to meet the plane. You will play the part of the bereaved widow and bring the coffin down to Basel. We will make the exchange in the garage, and you will arrange for my banker to have an armored car to take the tiger's head to his own premises from there. You've got it all worked out, haven't you?" "I hope so." I poured another whiskey. "My bank is Falle Fils, and the man to ask for is Monsieur Chalon. When you meet him, you will give him my name and the number of my account, 1066, the same as the Battle of Hastings. You must arrange with Monsieur Chalon for a private room to which we can invite dealers to view the head." I went on explaining in detail the arrangements I'd made, and she listened intently. Now and then she asked a question, but mostly she was silent, and at last I produced the air ticket and a thin sheaf of traveller's checks to carry her through. "You've made the reservations already?" She looked startled, and when I nodded, she thumbed open the booklet of the air ticket. "When do I leave?" "On the noon plane tomorrow." "And when will you follow?" "On the same plane as the coffin, 3 days later, on Friday. I will come in on the BOAC flight at 1:30 p.m. That will give you time to make the arrangements and be there to meet me." That night was as tender and loving as it had ever been, but even so I sensed a deeper mood of melancholia in Sherry as the time of leave-taking and farewell. In the dawn, the dolphins met us at the entrance of the bay, and we romped with them for half the morning and then swam in slowly to the beach. I drove her out to the airport in the old pickup. For most of the ride she was silent, and then she tried to tell me something, but she was confused and didn't make sense. She ended lamely. "If anything ever happens to us, well, I mean, nothing lasts forever, does it?" "Go on." "No, it's nothing. Just that we should try to forgive each other if anything does happen." And that is all she would say. At the airport barrier, she kissed me briefly and clung for a second with both arms about my neck. Then she turned and walked quickly to the waiting aircraft. She did not look back or wave as she climbed the boarding ladder. I watched the aircraft climb swiftly and head out across the inshore channel for the mainland. Then I drove slowly back to Turtle Bay. It was a lonely place without her. And that night, as I lay alone under the mosquito net on the wide bed, I knew that the risk I was about to take was necessary. Highly dangerous, but necessary. I knew I must have her back here. Without her, it would all be tasteless. I must gamble on the pull I would be able to exert over her, outweighing the other forces that governed her. I must let her make the choice herself, but I must try to influence it with every ploy in my power. In the morning, I drove into St. Mary's, and after Fred Coker and I had argued and consulted and passed money and promises back and forth, he opened the double doors to his warehouse, and I drove the pickup in beside the hearse. We loaded one of his best coffins, teak, with silver gilt handles and red velvet-lined interior, into the back of the truck. I covered it with a sheet of canvas and drove back to Turtle Bay. When I'd packed the coffin and screwed down the lid, it weighed almost 500 pounds. When it was dark, I drove back into town, and it was almost closing time at the Lord Nelson before I'd completed my arrangements. I just had time for a quick drink, and then I drove back to Turtle Bay to pack my battered old canvas campaign bag. At the noon of the next day, 24 hours earlier than I'd arranged with Sherry North, I boarded the aircraft for the mainland and that evening caught the BOAC connection onwards from Nairobi. There was no one to meet me at Zurich Airport, but I was a full day early, and I passed quickly through customs and immigration and went out into the vast arrivals halls. I checked my luggage before I went about tidying up the final loose threads of my plan. I found a flight outwards leaving at 1:20 the following day, which suited my timing admirably. I made a single reservation, then I drifted over to the inquiries desk and waited until the pretty little blonde girl in the Swissair uniform was not busy before engaging her in a long explanation. At first she was adamant, but I gave her the old crinkled eyes and smiled that way, until at last she became intrigued with it all and giggled in anticipation. "And you're sure you'll be on duty tomorrow?" I asked anxiously. "Oh, yes, monsieur. Don't worry. I will be here." We parted as friends, and I retrieved my bag and caught a cab to the Zurich Holiday Inn just down the road, the same hotel where I'd sweated out the survival of the Dutch policeman so long ago. I ordered a drink, took a bath, and then settled down in front of the television set. It brought back memories. A little before noon the following day, I sat at the airport cafe pretending to read a copy of the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung and watching the arrivals hall over the top of the page. I had already checked my baggage and my ticket. All I had to do was to go through into the final departure lounge. I was wearing a new suit, purchased that morning of such a bizarre cut and a mousy shade of grey that no one who knew him could believe that Harry Fletcher would be seen in public wearing it. It was two sizes too large for me, and I'd padded myself with hotel towels to alter my shape entirely. I had also self-barbered my hair into a short and ragged style and dusted it with talcum powder to put 15 years on my age. When I peered at my image through gold-rimmed spectacles in the mirror of the men's room, I didn't even recognize myself. At 1:07, Sherry North walked in through the main doors of the terminal. She wore a suit of grey checked wool, a full-length black leather coat, and a small matching leather hat with a narrow business-like brim. Her eyes were screened by a pair of dark glasses, but her expression was set and determined as she strode through the crowds of tourists. I felt the sick slide and churn of my guts as I saw all my fears confirmed. Following a pace behind and to her side was the small, neatly dressed figure of the man she'd introduced to me as Uncle Dan. He wore a tweed cap and carried an overcoat across his arm. More than ever, he exuded an air of awareness, the hunter's alert and confident tread as he followed the girl. He had four of his men with him. They moved quietly after him, quiet, soberly dressed men, with closed, watchful faces. "Oh, you little bitch," I whispered. but I wondered why I should feel so bitter. I'd known for long enough now. The group of girl and five men stopped in the centre of the hall, and I watched dear Uncle Dan issuing his orders. He was a professional. You could see that in the way he staked out the hall for me. He placed his men to cover the arrivals gate and every exit. Sherry North stood listening quietly, her face neutral and her eyes hidden by the glasses. Once Uncle Dan spoke to her, and she nodded abruptly, and then, when the four strong-armed men had been placed, two of them stood together facing the arrivals gate. "Get out now, Harry," a little warning voice urged me. "Don't play fancy games. This is the wolf pack all over again. Run, Harry, run." Just then, the public address system called the outward flight on which I had made a reservation the previous day. I stood up from the table in my cheap baggy suit and shuffled across to the inquiries desk. The little blonde Swissair hostess did not recognize me at first, and then her mouth dropped and her eyes flew wide. She covered her mouth with her hand, and her eyes sparkled with conspiratorial glee. "The end booth," she whispered. "The end nearest the departures gate." I winked at her and shuffled away. In the telephone booth, I lifted the receiver and pretended to be speaking. But I broke the connection with a finger on the bar, and I watched the hall through the glass door. I heard my accomplice paging. "Miss Sherry North, will Miss North please report to the inquiries desk?" Through the glass, I saw Sherry approach the desk and speak with the hostess. The blonde girl pointed to the booth beside mine, and Sherry turned and walked directly towards me. She was screened from Uncle Dan and his merry men by the row of booths. The leather coat swung gracefully about her long legs, and her hair was glossy black and bouncing on her shoulders at each stride. I saw she wore black leather gloves to hide her injured hand, and I thought she'd never looked so beautiful as in this moment of my betrayal. She entered the booth beside me and lifted the receiver. Swiftly, I replaced my own telephone and stepped out of the booth. As I opened her door, she looked around with impatient annoyance. "Okay, you dumb cop. Give me a good reason why I shouldn't break your head," I said.
You?
Her expression crumpled, and her hand flew to her mouth. We stared at each other. "What happened? To the real Sherry North?" I demanded, and the question seemed to steady her. "She was killed. We found her body almost unrecognizable in a quarry outside Ascot." "Manny Resnick told me he'd killed her," I said. "I didn't believe him. He also laughed at me when I went on board to do a deal with him and Suleiman Dada for your life. I called you Sherry North, and he laughed at me and called me a fool." I grinned at her lopsidedly. "He was right, wasn't he? I was a fool." She was silent then, unable to meet my eyes. I went on talking, confirming what I'd guessed. "So after Sherry North was killed, they decided not to announce her identity, but to stake out the North Cottage, hoping that the killers would return to investigate the new arrival, or that some other patsy would be sucked in and lead them home. They chose you for the stakeout, because you were a trained police diver. That's right, isn't it?" She nodded, still not looking at me. "They should have made sure you knew something about conchology as well. Then you wouldn't have grabbed that piece of fire coral and saved me a lot of trouble." She was over the first shock of my appearance. Now was the time to whistle for Uncle Dan and his men, if she was going to. She remained silent, her face half turned away, her cheek flushed with bright blood beneath the dark golden tan. "That first night when you telephoned, when you thought I was asleep, you were reporting to your superior officer that a sucker had walked in, and they told you to play me along. And, oh, baby, how you played." She looked at me at last, dark blue eyes snapping with defiance. Words seemed to boil behind her closed lips, but she held them back, and I went on. "That's why you used the back entrance to Jimmy's shop, to avoid the neighbours who knew Sherry. That's why these two goons of Manny's arrived to roast your fingers on the gas ring. They wanted to find out who you were, because you sure as hell went Sherry North. They'd killed her." I wanted her to speak. Now, her silence was wearing my nerves. And what rank is Uncle Dan? Inspector? Chief Inspector, she said. I had him tabbed the moment I laid eyes on him.
If you knew all this, then why did you go through with it?
I was suspicious at first, but by the time I knew for certain, I was, well, crazy, stupid, in love with you. She braced herself as though I'd struck her, and I went on remorselessly. I thought, by some of the things we did together, that you felt pretty good about me. In my book, when you love someone, you don't sell them down the river. I'm a policewoman, she flashed at me, and you're a killer. I never killed a man who wasn't trying to kill me first, I flashed back. Just the way you hit Suleiman Dada. That caught her off balance. She stammered and looked about her as if she were in a trap. Well, you're a thief, she attacked again. Yes, I agreed. I was once, but that was a long time ago. And since then I worked hard on it. With a bit of help, I'd have made it. The throne, she went on. That throne, you're stealing the throne. Oh, no, ma'am, I grinned at her. What is in the coffin, then? £300 of beach sand from Turtle Bay. When you see it, think of the grand times we had there. The throne. Where is it? With its rightful owner, the representative of the people of St. Mary's, President Godfrey Biddle. You gave it up. And she stared at me with disbelief that faded slowly as something else began to dawn in her eyes. But why, Harry? Why? Like I said, I'm working hard on it. Again we were staring hard at each other, and suddenly I saw the clear liquid flooding her dark blue eyes. And you came here, knowing what I had to do? She asked, her voice choking. I wanted you to make a choice, I said, and she let the tears cling like dewdrops in the thick, dark eyelashes. I went on deliberately. I'm going to walk out of this booth and go out through that gate. If nobody blows the whistle, I'll be on the next flight out of here, and there after tomorrow I will swim out through the reef to look for the dolphin. They'll come after you, Harry, she said. And I shook my head. President Biddle has just altered his extradition agreements. Nobody will be able to touch me on St. Mary's. I have his word for it. I turned and opened the door of the booth. I'm going to be lonely as all hell out there at Turtle Bay. I turned my back on her then and walked slowly and deliberately to the departure gate, just as they called my flight for the second time. It was the longest and scariest walk of my entire life, and my heart thumped in time to my footsteps. Nobody challenged me, and I didn't dare look back. As I settled into the seat of the Swissair Caravelle and fastened my seatbelt, I wondered how long it would take her to screw up her nerve enough to follow me out to St. Mary's, and I reflected that there was much I still had to tell her. I had to tell her that I'd contracted to raise the rest of the gold throne from Gunfire Break for the benefit of the people of St. Mary's. In return, President Godfrey Biddle had undertaken to buy me a new deep-sea boat from the proceeds, just like Wave Dancer, as a token of the people's gratitude. I would be able to keep my lady in the style to which I was accustomed. And, of course, there was always the case of Georgian silver gilt plate buried behind the shack at Turtle Bay for the lean and hungry off-season. I hadn't reformed that much. There would, however, be no more night runs. As the caravel took off and climbed steeply up over the blue lakes and the forested mountains, I realized that I didn't even know her real name. That would be the first thing I would ask her when I met her at the airport of St. Mary's Island, Pearl of the Indian Ocean. And that is the end of The Eye of the Tiger by Wilbur Smith.